Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Can someone tell me what they were putting in the water back in the 70s? They said it was just fluoride, but come on. Have you seen the stuff we bought in the record stores back then? I mean, one novelty song after another made its way onto the pop charts. Remember The Streak?
Here he comes.
Boogity, boogity.
Here he goes.
Boogity, boogity.
And he ain't wearing no clothes.
Oh, yes, they call him The Streak.
That was a hit. And what about that novelty song about boxer Muhammad Ali?
He knows how to talk, and he knows how to fight. And all the contenders were beat out of sight. Sing Muhammad, Muhammad Ali.
That was a hit, too. So was Convoy, an ode to CB radios and avoiding speeding tickets.
Golly, it's clean, clear to Flagtown. Come on. Yeah, it's a big 10-4 there, Big Ben. Yeah, we definitely got the front door, good buddy. Mercy sakes alive, looks like we got us a convoy.
I mean, seriously, what were we thinking? It was like, hey, I've written a song about ballpoint pens. Great, we all want to buy copies. This is why we have our ongoing series called That Was a Hit, to try to make sense of songs that you'd never expect to be pop hits. Today, we tackle one of the 70s biggest novelty hits.
Everybody was kung fu fighting. Those kids were fast as lightning. In fact, it was a little bit frightening. But they fought with expert timing.
Yes, kung fu fighting goes under the soundcheck microscope. Find out how this politically incorrect, ha-infested song became a pop hit. That's coming up, and then we'll all take a deep, cleansing breath and hear some terrific live music from singer, songwriter, and producer Jonathan Wilson. Actually, his music looks back to the 70s, too, but to the classic sounds of Laurel Canyon. To begin, though, it's time for another recurring segment that we call Pick 3. It's our chance to invite a special guest to share a playlist of three favorite songs, and joining us today is author Philip Meyer. His recent novel, The Sun, wound up on many Best of 2013 lists, New York Times, USA Today, Chicago Tribune, and The Washington Post. The Sun is just out in paperback, and it brings Philip Meyer to our studio. Welcome to Soundcheck.
Thanks, John.
So The Sun is, I mean, this is epic. It's like almost 200 years of American history seen through the prism of one family. Your first novel, American Rust, was no slouch in terms of, you know, subject matter, but was there, like, did you feel the need to go epic, to go big for the second book?
Yeah, I think I did. American Rust was set in a small kind of dying steel town in western Pennsylvania. It was about the first generation of kids to grow up there after the mills had shut. I grew up in Baltimore, which was kind of a mix of a steel town, the huge auto industry. My neighborhood was a textile mill neighborhood. And those mills had closed about 10 years before we got there. You know, when you get to the 80s, late 70s, everyone's out of work.
Right. So
this first book, American Rust, was about the kind of the end of the American dream for a large portion of the middle class. For The Sun, I wanted to, and people thought this was depressing for some reason, I guess.
So you wanted to write something uplifting about race and the rush for oil and the end of the American West.
That's what I thought.
It's a laugh riot, Philip.
I know, Ralph, really funny book. So the second book, I kind of wanted to take on the time when the country was still expanding and when there was a little bit more realistic that you could, you know, arrive on some part of the East Coast with no name and nothing and move west and kind of reinvent yourself. Once I got into the research, I realized the people who settled the country, the people who lived on the frontier, were not the sort of middle class, upper middle class, stable family type people that we sort of have been taught to think they were. These are the people who had nothing to lose. I mean, why else? The frontier was a combat zone, whether you're talking 1650 when it was just west of here, whether you're talking 1850 when it was going through Texas. You know, it basically looked like Iraq. You know, we the one group of people who were Anglo were moving into the territory that was had been lived in for 15,000 years by another group of people, various Native American tribes. And, you know, no one wants to give up their resources and land without a fight. So the frontier was an absolute combat zone.
And then you have a third group coming from the south.
Right. I mean, the Spanish were here 100 years before the English.
Yeah.
And we sort of conveniently forget that all, you know, the oldest cities are, you know, they're in New Mexico. I mean, Santa Fe is 500 years old, but it's nice to forget that because it doesn't fit in with the sort of pilgrim mentality.
Yeah, the idea of America as an eastern country that has gradually moved west,
exactly,
as opposed to something southwestern that has, you know, seen lots of invasions from different
places. And then the French, of course. I mean, and it's so researching this book and writing it just showed me sort of how flawed all these different mythologies were. I wanted to make a family and make characters that would allow me to show that without ever saying it out loud, you know?
So who is the son? Because we're following Eli, who's sort of the patriarch of the family.
Yeah.
We do see Peter, his son, through his diaries.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And then we have Jeannie, who is Peter's
granddaughter. Yeah.
And who is, you know, it's 2012. She's a very modern person. I mean, she's ancient, and
sure,
she's lying on the floor dying. And so who's the son?
Well, so they all are.
Even Jeannie.
And Jeannie, of course, trying to play with the notion of the idea that the firstborn son would inherit everything and continue the family. This, in Jeannie's case, is not true at all. Her older brothers are sort of useless, dilettante, you know, rich kids, and she's the one who has to carry the name forward and kind of save the family and save the fortune.
We're speaking with Philip Meyer, author of the novel The Son, an epic family drama set in Texas beginning in the 1840s when
Exactly.
Eli's, his family is mostly wiped out and he's kidnapped by the Comanches. There's not a lot of music in this book. Are you, I would have assumed that there was lots of, you know, that people would, you know, think of Little House on the Prairie, the dad with his fiddle, you know, that sort of thing happened a lot. Was it difficult? I mean, you're a music person, right? You're a music fan. Was it difficult to kind of, you know, put that off to the side for a while?
I think so. The crucial thing when you're making any sort of art is that it's in some way fundamentally based in reality, or at least a reality that could exist. And so the McCullough family actually does, you know, they have a sort of primitive piano that the mother's transported into the frontier. But when you're trying to shoehorn your own tastes into things, people can always smell it. And it always comes out seeming false. And so I think I'm quite nervous about that stuff. And every time, I write a sentence in which I think, God, that sentence is brilliant. This character is sort of explaining the state of America exactly as it is. I always delete it because I'm always sort of so worried about characters in the book, people in the book saying things that I believe that they wouldn't necessarily, you know, believe.
So 18th century piano, you're not likely to hear somebody banging out the Clash.
if only. Yeah.
So your pick three starts with the Clash and actually a track from London Calling. You would have been like 6 when this album came out.
Yeah.
So how and when did you come to the Clash?
I guess probably the end of middle school, probably the first year of high school, which for me would have been 1988, you know.
Right.
So this was just one of these things that you understand somehow the intent or the tone or the emotion before you understand what the song is actually about. And this song always moved me. It was one of these things that I listened to on repeat. I would, this is back when I still listened to records. Now it's hip to do that. Before, it was actually really annoying. So because you had to, you know, lift up the needle and play the song again, lift up the needle, and I would do this like 30
times. I remember
times
how records work, yes.
For our listeners who don't.
So the song is Guns of Brixton. So did you, how long were you listening to this before you actually had the light bulb moment, said, oh, that's what that song's about?
You know, it probably was, you know, 6 months, a year. I mean, quite a long time, because, of course, there was no internet then, and you had to figure out lyrics on your own and the sort of hilarious interpretations, you know, of lyrics that we all would have back in those days. And I realized, okay, you know, this is about people who are, in a way, like the people I grew up with. They're oppressed. This is the beginning of Thatcherism. You know, everyone in the north of England is losing their jobs. The people in the cities are feeling the squeeze as well. All the social services are being cut, and these people are going to lash out at whomever they can.
Right, which tended to be blacks and Caribbeans. And
absolutely, yeah.
So there is that sort of reggae kind of flavor to the song.
For sure, yeah.
From The Clash, from their classic 2-LP set London Calling, this is Guns of Brixton.
When they kick at your front door, how you gonna come? Put your hands on your head, on the trigger.
Guns of Brixton, a classic from The Clash, from their album London Calling, released in 79. Philip Meyer, picking three for us, sharing his pick three playlist with us in the Soundcheck studio. He is the author of the book The Sun, and before that, American Rust, a Guggenheim fellow as well, and my guest here in the Soundcheck studio. The only band that matters. That's what we called them for a number of years.
It still feels that way.
Yeah. So the Clash, they were sort of led by Joe Strummer. They were very clearly socially conscious, socially
sure.
aware,
yeah.
you know, race relations. A lot of the themes that, you know, are part and parcel of The Sun.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think that stuff's always concerned me. I've always been concerned just with the way systems work. How do these sort of social structures work? Who puts them in place?
Who questions them?
Who questions them? Who actively fights for them? And I've always had a sense, which is reinforced after I spent a couple of years on Wall Street, that none of this was – nothing is really accidental, even though the powers that be want you to believe it is.
Yeah.
You know, of course, it's all intentional.
What did you do on Wall Street?
I was a derivatives trader.
And how'd that work out for you?
That I made it a couple of years and then I had to pull out. Yeah, I realized I was an artist. So I grew up in this blue-collar neighborhood in Baltimore, and my parents were artists and kind of hippie intellectual types. We never had any money, and it was just, you know, there's some kids, when you come from that environment, you sort of accept it, and there are other people. I hated being poor, and so I was a bit of a delinquent, dropped out of high school. Standard American redemption story. But I drop out when I'm 16, get a GED. Early 20s, decide to go to college. Mid 20s, get into an Ivy League school, kind of through the back door, basically as a transfer student, and graduate when I'm 25 with a degree from Cornell and my GED, and get a job on Wall Street as a trader, thinking, okay, this is the American dream. I'm living it.
Have you seen Wolf of Wall Street?
I have, and it's very accurate. I mean, it's not. None of that stuff is exaggerated, actually. I certainly began to have questions about, you know, which side I sort of belonged to, and I'd come from this and seen all these people growing up with nothing who were, in many cases, were just as smart or smarter than the guys I was working with on Wall Street. But, you know, the guys that work, most people who come here work on Wall Street, they come from money and good families. And I began to see, okay, this is the difference. It's not that they work harder. It's just what you come from kind of determines your future.
It's interesting, you know, you talk about trying to figure out which side you're on because, you know, one of the interesting things about the main characters that we follow in The Sun is you're not really sure in terms of the social order which side they're on, you know, whether they're
sure.
within it,
yeah.
whether they're sort of a part of it without knowing, whether they're actively pushing against it. You know, sometimes what they think they're doing is in fact not what they think they're doing.
For sure. I mean, especially on the frontier, it's quite common for people to – you'd end up fighting for this group and then you'd be captured by one Indian tribe and then traded or sold to another Indian tribe. It was just – there was a fluidity to sides that to us – would seem most like something that would be recognizable from a sort of civil war. Yeah. You'd go from one side to another. But on the frontier, because it basically was a combat zone, there was no time and it was peaceful. The frontier was never peaceful. That sort of flipping was fairly constant. And this idea of a sort of coherent national identity and sort of us being on this side or this side, that's new. You know, that really began, you know, the 1890.
And even who's good and who's bad. I mean, Eli is a very likable character, but he does some horrible things.
Sure. And I think hopefully one of the questions the book is asking is at what point does the need for survival and sort of might being required just to protect your family and make it through today or tonight turn into might makes right? At what point does power save you? And at what point does power completely corrupt you?
Philip Meyer sharing a Pick 3 playlist with us on Soundcheck. And the second song we're going to play is from the Dropkick Murphys. Now, this is an arrangement of an old Union song.
For sure.
That does try to make that distinction very clear, that this group of people is absolutely right, that group of people is absolutely wrong.
Sure. And so this song was written by a lady whose husband was a union organizer during the Harlan County Wars in Kentucky.
So this would be the early 30s.
Correct. Yeah. So these things went on for – they were trying to sort of unionize this part, these coal mines, for about 10 years. And it was written – the sheriff was completely in the pockets of the mine owners. Mm-hmm. And they were basically shooting people whenever they felt like it. So they came into her house looking to execute her husband. Who managed to barely escape. They roughed her up, roughed her kids up, trashed her house. And after they left, she basically wrote this song. And it was covered by Pete Seeger and a bunch of other people. It's been covered by a million people. Mm-hmm. But for some reason, I like this, the Dropkick Murphys version. It was the first version I heard, and I heard it as I was thinking about leaving Wall Street. I mean, I'm not sure it was the major contributor to my choice, but it certainly made me think because, you know, when you come from, you know, even though, again, my parents were sort of educated intellectuals, when you grow up among the sort of working class and you're surrounded by the wealthy, there's a sense of schizophrenia you feel basically every day.
Cover of an old Union song from the Dropkick Murphys, the Celtic punk band from Massachusetts. Which Side Are You On? From their 2001 record, Sing Loud, Sing Proud. Philip Meyer, the author with me on Soundcheck, sharing his Pick 3 playlist. The Sun is now out in paperback, and a TV series is in the works?
Yeah, it is. Some friends of mine and I are hopefully going to write and produce it and run the show. And so, at a bunch of negotiations are going on.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Are you thinking miniseries or something more extensive?
We were. In fact, we went into all these very prissy Hollywood meetings a couple weeks ago thinking it was a miniseries, but the Sun ended up being about 600 pages in print. Mm-hmm. There are at least 4,000 or 5,000 good pages of material that I left out because it was just so much.
Well, you did so much research.
Oh, it was you're covering 175 years of pretty eventful history. So, I read about 350 books, and I kind of learned how to track animals and learned how to live on the plains.
Did you drink buffalo blood?
I did, yeah. I drank a cup of warm buffalo blood, which is not actually intending to, but I'd gone to a buffalo ranch.
Wait a minute, you accidentally drank?
Well, no, it was a sort of a spur of the moment decision, let's say. It was not a planned out thing, but this is the animal that, you know, was the largest herbivore in North America, all the plains, Indian tribes depended on it. And I thought, okay, there's no way you can write about Native Americans at this time period without understanding the animal, how it smells, how it tastes, and, you know, not after it comes off the grill of your steakhouse, but actually right, has been butchered.
All right. So all this research going into the book called The Sun, and Philip Meyer with us here in the Soundcheck studio. Before we wrap up here, I do have to ask you, you referred to hippie parents before. Maybe that's going to be the answer here. But your first name, I have never seen Philip spelled P-H-I-L-I-P-P.
Yes, that is the old German spelling. My parents named me after C.P.E. Bach.
And so, Carl Philipp Emanuel Bach.
Exactly. Yeah. So, when I was in Germany and Switzerland doing my evil work for this investment book, I saw it was quite common to see Philip spelled that way.
Really?
It's sort of like Philippe. Yeah. It's like the French spelling minus the E.
Right.
But it's cursed me my entire life. It was spelled wrong on my passport for a while. And now these books are in print, of course, it's spelled correctly everywhere. But this is the first time. I'm very excited.
All right. So our Pick 3 playlist brings us back to The Clash. A few years later, the album Combat Rock. And you picked the song Straight to Hell. What about this? I mean, this is sort of a family drama, isn't it?
Oh, sure. I mean, so this is another one of these things in which, you know, the way music works and the way art works is that, you know, it hopefully moves you emotionally first. Actually, it has to. It's almost like love in this way, in which you have this feeling and you know something's important and a song is important to you, even though you might not, and you probably don't understand the meaning at first. This is another thing, a song I found quite compelling, and then as I sort of began to listen to and dissect the lyrics, I realized, okay, again, this is about the loss of steel mill jobs in England and the sort of, again, sort of deindustrialization that I was watching happen in my own neighborhood. And then the sort of the leftovers and the sort of war orphans from Vietnam, and then a sort of a general statement on the plight of immigrants all over the place, people who are sort of left between borders and left without a home.
So the song is Straight to Hell from The Clash, from their album Combat Rock, picked for us by Philip Meyer, whose latest novel, The Sun, is now out in paperback. Philip, it's been great fun talking to you. Thanks very much.
John.
If you could play a fiddle, how's about a British jig and reel? Speaking King's English in quotation. As railhead towns feel the steel mills rust, water froze in the generation. Clear as winter ice, this is your paradise. There ain't no need for ya. There ain't no need for ya. Go straight to hell, boys. Go straight to hell, boys.
So Philip Meyer and I were just talking about Which Side Are You On?, the Union song written by Florence Reese in 1931. Well, in the lead up to a very special event, we're going to ask you to pick a side in one of the most grueling battles in pop culture history. The Beatles versus the Rolling Stones. You see, we're doing a soundcheck
smackdown.
Whoa. Kill the music. We're not doing the smackdown right now. It's actually happening in front of a live audience on Thursday, February 27th, at the New York Public Library for the Performing Arts. Arguing for Team Rolling Stones, journalist and musician Bill Janovitz from the band Buffalo Tom, and Ophira Eisenberg of NPR and WNYC's Ask Me Another. And for Team Beatles,
help! I need somebody.
Help!
Not just anybody.
Help!
You know I need someone.
Help!
When I was younger, so much younger than today, I never needed anybody's help in any way.
the journalist and music biographer Paul Myers. And Paul's bringing his brother, the actor Mike Myers. Yes, from Wayne's World and Austin Powers. That's Thursday, February 27th at 6 p.m. A very limited number of tickets will be available at the door on a first-come, first-served basis. Before then, though, we need your help. Pick a side, Beatles or Rolling Stones, and make your case on soundcheck.org or call our listener line, 866-939-1612. Up next, there's no debating that Kung Fu Fighting is a weird song. And it's the latest installment in our series, That Was a Hit? Next on Soundcheck.
And now, Soundcheck looks back at the pop charts of yesteryear and asks,
That was a hit?
Everybody was Kung Fu Fighting.
They're coming to take me away, haha.
Time now for another installment of That Was a Hit, our series about baffling chart success. Today, we look back at one of the biggies. In fact, it's one of the songs that we excerpt in our theme song. You heard it just a moment ago. And that is Kung Fu Fighting by Carl Douglas. And joining us once again is Chris Malanfi, pop chart analyst and contributor to NPR Music Slate and Pitchfork. Hey, Chris.
How you doing, John?
Good. How big a hit was this thing?
This was a pretty enormous hit. If you were alive in 1974 and listening to a radio either here or in the UK, guaranteed you heard this song.
Like daily.
Oh, heck yeah. Yeah. And 74 is like the early days of popular disco, right? Like disco has already been in clubs for a while, but it's just starting to really cross over. This is even before The Hustle. It's, I believe, the same year as Rock the Boat by the Hughes Corporation. This is a fairly early club-oriented 70s hit. And in America, at least, it's totally a one-hit wonder for Carl Douglas.
Let's hear a little bit of the song Kung Fu Fighting by Carl Douglas.
Everybody was Kung Fu. But they fought with expert timing. There were funky Chinamen from funky Chinatown. They were chopping them up, they were chopping them down. It's an ancient Chinese art, and everybody knew their part. From a fainting to a slip, and a kicking from the hip, everybody was Kung Fu Fighting.
Carl Douglas and Kung Fu Fighting, that was a behemoth in 1974, early
Definitely.
75. Why?
I want to say that Carl Douglas was catching a wave at a perfect moment. The Kung Fu craze, if you can call it that, was absolutely ascendant by 1974-75. You know, the David Carradine TV show Kung Fu was in, I believe, its third season at this point, and a pretty big hit. Bruce Lee, of course, famously died tragically the year before in 73, just as his movie Enter the Dragon was about to be released. And that movie, in a way, his death became made him a legend. Enter the Dragon made tens of millions of dollars worldwide. So Kung Fu was absolutely at its apex. Douglas himself was kind of channeling that when he wrote the song. He co-wrote it with a producer who goes by the name Bidu. He is of Indian descent. Carl Douglas is of Jamaican descent. And we'll talk about that later because that makes him gives him some interesting status on the U.S. charts. And Douglas actually spent most of his later years in England. So he was living in England, recording in England. He had had a couple of British groups in the 60s. And then as he tells the story, I had to look this up in one of the Billboard books. He was passing a club in Soho, not even a club. He claims it was like a pinball hall in Soho, in England, the English
the
Soho.
London Soho.
London
yeah.
Soho, exactly. And he saw a bunch of kids that were mock fighting in time with the record that was playing in the pinball club. And he said to his friend, damn, it looks like everybody's Kung Fu Fighting. And at that moment, he said, I heard it all in my head, melody line as well. I had to rush home and write it down. But that the story doesn't end there. And this is one of my favorite asides to the song. This thing was never meant to be a frontline promoted hit. Douglas had befriended Bidoux, the producer, a couple years earlier when they worked on a Richard Roundtree movie called Embassy. And Bidoux at the time had a track that he was dying to get somebody to record. The track was called I Just Want to Give You My Everything. And it was written by Larry Weiss, who later had a number one hit with Rhinestone Cowboy. So Larry Weiss is like a songsmith, and he's written various things. Bidoux wants to record this song, and he talks to Douglas, whom he's now worked with, and says, hey, do you want to go in and cut this track? They book studio time, just a couple of hours. They've got, you know, all the backing musicians and everything. They record the Weiss track. And they've got like 10 minutes left of studio time. So Bidoux...
And they need a B-side.
And they need a B-side. Exactly. Remember, kids, that, and for those of you who don't know, you know, 45 RPM records, they had an A-side and they had a B-side. And the B-side was often an afterthought. And they needed a B-side. So Bidoux turns to Douglas and says, do you have anything? And he says, well, I've got this, I've got this, I've got these other lyrics I wrote for this goofy thing about kung fu fighting. And Bidoux said, yeah, all right, we'll do that. And so lickety-split, in 10 minutes, they threw together a recording of this thing.
Here comes the big boss. Hey, hey. Let's get it on. We took a bow and made a stand. Started swaying with the hand. A sudden motion made me skip. Now we're into a brand new trip. Everybody was kung fu fighting.
Bidoux brings the two tracks to Pye Records, P-Y-E, which is the label in England that they were signed to. And they play it for the A&R team and they said, that's the A side.
That's the hit.
That's the hit. And again, don't forget, it's now, this is around spring of 1974. The kung fu fad is at full throttle. You can imagine they saw dollar signs in their heads when they heard this track.
And then they would hear it again and again, because over the years it's been covered so many times, beginning with this 1976 version by Lloyd Parks.
Everybody was kung fu fighting. Those guys.
Joka pelätyn kungfun taitaa, voi sitä kaikki voittaa. Lyöt rikki vaikka kivistä aitaa, sua kaikki kunnioittaa.
Everybody is kung fu fighting. Your mind becomes fast as lightning. Although the future is a little bit frightening.
Chris, we could have gone on and on with that little medley of covers.
Was that last one CeeLo?
That is CeeLo Green and Jack Black.
Wow.
Doing Kung Fu Fighting in a version for the movie Kung Fu Panda.
Of course.
But before that, we heard Frederick from Finland and Kung Fu Taistele, which is the Finnish version of Kung Fu Fighting.
My gosh.
Bus Stop from 1998, but featuring Carl Douglas, the original singer. And before that, Lloyd Parks from 1976, 2 years after the Carl Douglas original, in a kind of reggae version. Now, you mentioned Carl Douglas was originally from Jamaica.
Yes, and one interesting trivia detail is by going to number one on the American charts in December of 1974, believe it or not, he was the first artist of Jamaican descent to have a number one hit in America.
So he beat Bob Marley.
He beat Bob Marley. Bob Marley actually never had a number one hit.
Is that right? While he was alive.
Exactly. But he beat everybody.
Chris Melanfi's with us for our series That Was a Hit. And every time we do that series, we play a little medley of songs, and one of them is Kung Fu Fighting. And so finally, we're getting around to actually talking about this.
Exactly.
This genuine one-hit wonder. You know, you listen to it now, and early on in the song, Funky Chinaman from Funky Chinatown, right. And that kind of clangs on the ear a little bit these days.
And, well, the trope that it uses, which is one of the most overused tropes in Western music to indicate something Asian is what's called the Oriental riff. I did a little background research on this, actually.
The thing that goes...
Exactly. And I did a little research on this, and it actually is a Western invention. It dates back to the mid-19th century, and this thing recurs a lot. I can think of two top 40 hits from the early 80s that use it. I bet one of them you know right off the top of your head,
John. I would say The Vapors Turning Japanese.
Uh-huh, that's right. And I'll bet you know the other one, too.
Mm.
You'll kick yourself when I tell you. It's David Bowie.
Really?
China Girl.
Oh, China Girl, of course.
Yes. So both
not,
of those
not
hits,
in the original, not in the Iggy
correct,
Pop original.
Not in the Iggy Pop original, yeah. In the Let's Dance album cover, exactly.
All right. You're right. I'm kicking myself. So that's incorporated in it. So were there, you know, people saying, hey, you can't say Chinaman like that?
I don't think anybody was in 1974.
Yeah, I don't think so either.
I mean, the fact that this thing recurred through the 80s indicates that we are far more sensitive, rightfully, and politically correct when it comes to these things now.
And so Carl Douglas becomes a genuine one-hit wonder, not for lack of trying. What did he do next?
In England, he actually had a few more hits, none remotely as big. This was his last top 10 hit anywhere. In England, he managed a follow-up hit, which actually was a top 10 R&B hit here in America called Dance the Kung Fu. It missed the top 40 in America, hence he's pretty clearly a one-hit wonder. But on the R&B chart, it did make the top 10. In England, it made the top 30. He got two more top 20 hits in the late 70s, and then pretty much he was done.
So if you were paying attention, you might have heard his follow-up called Dance the Kung Fu. Nobody was paying attention, and so it wasn't a hit.
Can you say quickie follow-up?
Oh, my goodness. It's like it doesn't actually have the Oriental theme, but it's very close.
Right, and it's picking up the same trope, the same string arrangement. Yeah.
What this song needs is a few, ha!
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, that's one of the best stories is that the producer said that we were in the studio and we were recording this so fast, Kung Fu Fighting, of course, that we just threw the huzz and ahs in just off the top of our heads. I mean, really, it's one of the most accidental hits of all time.
So will this song be with us forever? Will it be the constant subject of covers and remixes and samples?
As long as Kung Fu Panda is in movie theaters, I think it's got to come back. I can't imagine that it's going to die anytime soon. It is the hit referencing the martial arts of the last 50 years.
Chris Melanfi is a pop chart analyst and contributor to NPR Music, Slate, and Pitchfork. Joins us regularly, especially for our series That Was a Hit, about surprising and even baffling chart success. Few are more baffling than Kung Fu Fighting by Carl Douglas. Chris, thanks very much.
Anytime, John.
Time.
Up next, live music from singer, songwriter, and producer Jonathan Wilson as he channels some of the classic sounds of the 70s here in the Soundcheck studio.
They want to show you to high cotton when you sing from slavery. They want to sell and reproduce your golden voice. They want to get down to the bottom of what.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Laurel Canyon is the famous neighborhood in L.A. that was the center of pop music in the late 60s and early 70s. Crosby, Stills and Nash, Carole King, James Taylor, The Eagles, Joni Mitchell, they all lived and made some of their most famous music there. These days, singer, songwriter, and producer Jonathan Wilson is channeling the Laurel Canyon sound on his latest record called Fanfare. Jonathan Wilson joins us here in the studio today. He's at our piano with guitarist Omar Velasco, and they're going to play for us a version of the title track from the album Fanfare live on Soundcheck. Let me love you. It's all that I can do. Not to touch you. And ooh, I'm in love with you. Yeah, look. Jonathan Wilson, live on Soundcheck, playing a song called Fanfare. That's the title track from Jonathan's most recent album. He was at our piano, Omar Velasco playing the 12-string guitar, live in the Soundcheck studio. And a very different sound, Jonathan, from the one that's on the record, which is like a big, lush, almost orchestral thing. Good to hear the two of you doing this version of here. Thanks very much. But it is a big song on the record.
Right.
And you're a producer, you know. How do you know when enough is enough? How do you know when the song needs to be bigger or smaller?
Yeah. I think when enough is enough is when the mixing desk is full, right?
When every track is covered. Every track has an instrument.
But actually, like that song, I mean, like it is a big sort of production, you know, and it's got strings and horns and, you know, and like the whole band and a saxophone, solo, and sort of a Roland Kirk freak out, you know, thing there. So,
and people are kind of, you know, responding to the Laurel Canyon thing. You lived in Laurel Canyon for a few years.
Yeah, I was there from 2005 till around 2011.
And certainly that sound is here. How could it not? You've got half of the Laurel Canyon people on this record,
right?
You know, Crosby and Jackson Brown, and you know, all
Graham's
these
on it too. Yeah. So,
apparently, while you were living in Laurel Canyon, you would do these kind of informal jam sessions and stuff. Is that how you met all these people?
Yeah, like that was definitely like the beginning of sort of the mass musical socialization there. You know, like when I came to town.
You mean it was a new beginning? Because
apparently, for me,
they'd been doing that like 40 years ago.
Right, but you know, at the time that I got there, you know, musically speaking, there wasn't a whole lot, happening. There was, you know, there was a few like guys from metal bands and stuff that were kind of scattered in the canyon still. Yeah, there was, you know, a bit of that, but there certainly was not an American sort of gathering of sound and stuff. And so, yeah, so we kind of started these parties there, and they definitely took off, and they kind of became a tradition there.
Do they still happen?
Not these days.
Because you've moved out of the canyon.
Yeah, and I've sort of...
So you must be the life of the party. You move out and all the music stops.
Well, that is the case like at this time, but, it'll sort of happen again there sometime soon.
It's not just the Laurel Canyon sound, though. I mean, there are references or allusions, sonic allusions to Pink Floyd, late Beatles. Fanfare reminds me of Funeral for a Friend, Elton John. But everything is that time period, late 60s, early 70s. What is it about that time period that draws you?
Yeah, I mean, I would say pretty much it's just the basic explanation is just sort of the medium, you know, of a band, maybe a quartet or a quintet, and then sort of what can be done, you know, like with that palette and stuff like that. And you know, that definitely segues into the recording style, like if you cut a song to tape and that type of thing. And
do you do that? Do you use tape?
Yeah.
As opposed to digital?
Yeah, not exclusively, but like every song starts on tape, for sure.
Wow. We're speaking with Jonathan Wilson, the singer, songwriter, pianist, guitarist, and producer. So you've picked up a guitar for this next song.
Yeah.
And this actually is from your first record,
right?
Yeah. You want to do Ballad of the Pines for us?
Yeah, man.
All right. Jonathan Wilson, and once again, Omar Velasco, also playing guitar. This song is called Ballad of the Pines.
All the time, feather and the goose come back speaking Spanish to me. I don't
Very nice. 18 strings worth of guitar going there in that live performance on Soundcheck. Jonathan Wilson singing and playing the 6-string guitar. Omar Velasco playing the 12-string guitar. Song's called Ballad of the Pines, and you will find a version of that on Jonathan's first record, the 2011 LP Gentle Spirit. The album is called Fanfare, the latest from Jonathan Wilson, who's been playing for us here in the Soundcheck studio. Jonathan, great to hear you in this kind of unplugged version.
Yeah, man.
Album sounds terrific. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.
So I brought with me these here 3 guitars, yeah, 1 for the cuts, 2 for the scars. Well, I'm not the only one who rode into town just to lay. Sun with the fern and eucalyptus, yeah, way up in the canyon. Cheer up, child, we'll drink that strawberry wine another time. We've arrived in the state of mind where everything's moving, dear, it's like limb to limb, mouth to mouth, and hey, yeah. You gotta love to love. You gotta love to love.
If you liked today's session with Jonathan Wilson, head over to soundcheck.org to hear an extra song that he performed here in the studio. Tomorrow on the show, the history of music at the Olympics, and a live performance from jazz pianist Helen Sung and her band. Plus, put your thinking caps on for a Beatles quiz. We'll give you two songs, and you need to decide which was the bigger hit on the American pop charts. Remember, all this week we're asking you to make your case. Beatles or Rolling Stones? Pick a side and tell us why at soundcheck.org or leave a voicemail at 866-939-1612. That's 866-939-1612 or soundcheck.org. That does it for the show today. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.